a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we're flashing back to what was originally episode 743 of the Survival Podcast, originally published on September the 13th, 2011. This was Paul Seyfried on NBC Underground Shelter Construction. This might fit pretty well with the episode that we did on Wednesday that triggered some people. I don't not own an underground shelter because of cost in general. It's the cost here. This is something I actually would do. Maybe not to the level of some of the types of shelters we're going to talk about today, but definitely like an underground storm shelter, and probably one bigger than I need for just that because it would be useful for other things. I'm not necessarily worried about surviving a nuclear bomb being dropped on Fort Worth. Though if you had one of these, okay, great. If that happens, then I got something. I see when you live in Tornado Alley, which I do, an extreme value in having a shelter system and also having it for other purposes. So I think this is a legitimate topic for preppers to consider. And again, the reason I don't have one is because it would take dynamite for me to have one. I guess I'd have a really good one, you know, if you think about it that way. But I look at everything that I do from a standpoint of what's the cost versus the benefit. And I don't see a cost-benefit ratio here. If I live somewhere where I could do a lot of the work myself with a backhoe, I might have one. I might even be broadcasting from it because what a great sound studio it would be. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and flash back to September 13th, 2011. Originally episode 743, and we're going to talk about underground shelter construction. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, I have Paul Seyfried on the line here, and he's going to talk to us today about shelters, and it's something we don't really talk about a lot on the air. We probably should talk about them more. So I've got an expert here to discuss this with us. Paul is the president and CEO of UtahShelterSystems.com. He built his first shelter back in 1985 together with a partner, Sharon Packer. They've built several hundred since, and they supply them to private individuals and governments. They also market hatches and switch shelter components for folks building their own shelters. And, you know, of course, shelters is his full-time business, and he's here to talk to us about them. Paul, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Great. You know, I don't really haven't done a lot on shelters. I've done a little bit on burying shipping containers and some other things like that, and thoughts on things like root cellars and all, which can kind of sort of be a shelter. But, you know, just leading off, why should people be building a shelter now that the Cold War is over?
Well, I guess it depends on what your definition of the Cold War is. My definition of the Cold War is that we had an imminent threat of invasion by the Warsaw Pact in Western Europe. And those forces have largely, you know, dissolved. And the countries that used to be in the Warsaw Pact are now mostly independent and are friendly to the West. But these nuclear arsenals of both sides of the Cold War are still very much intact. And Russia continues to modernize and upgrade their nuclear deterrent, as well as Red China. And, of course, there are other countries that are less stable that are joining the game, such as Iran and North Korea, and now Syria is also aspiring to a nuclear program. So the nuclear genie is out of the bottle, and there are countries that are not friendly toward the United States that still possess or will soon possess the ability to deliver nuclear weapons into the United States.
Okay, and I mean, part of me looks at this and says that, you know, a shelter's not just for nuclear warfare. It could be for anything from other types of attacks that I guess we'll get into a little bit later, like, you know, biological or chemical, but it also would be a good place to shelter for, you know, people throughout the South that live in places where they don't even have a basement and they live in the middle of Tornado Alley.
That's correct. We saw some horrific tornadoes this last season in Alabama and western Missouri and Kansas. And, I have a lot of customers who built their shelters for the nuclear, biological, chemical threat, but they also take comfort in having them when there are tornadoes on the ground in their county. And, they're good for winter storms, massive power failures. You know, you won't be able to heat or cool your house. Your shelter is still a standby living arrangement where you can live in some degree of comfort and safety.
What makes a good shelter? What makes a shelter, like, let's say, a proper shelter? What are some of the characteristics it needs to have? I mean, is it just a hole in the ground or a bunker? Or is there certain things that, if you want to do it right, you really need to kind of button down?
Well, there are several things you need to address to build a shelter, and there are lots of ways to build one, depending on your resource envelope. But the first thing you need to consider is the shielding factor. And we run into a lot of people who build concrete box in the ground. And they, when they call us later on when they're done to tell us, you know, what they've done, they have an 8-inch thick concrete ceiling, which is totally inadequate and will prove absolutely worthless in a nuclear environment. What you really need, if you're going to stick with solely concrete for your shielding material, is about 30 inches of concrete in the ceiling. And that will provide a very acceptable level of protection. Shielding, 4 feet of dirt or more. We typically bury our shelters 10 feet deep in the ground, so there's 10 feet of cover over the top, which would reduce, you know, your nuclear exposure in an attack to near zero. Of course, after shielding, you have to look at proper ventilation. You have to be able to maintain a comfortable temperature in your shelter, and you do that primarily by air exchange. But you also need to be able to remove from the outside air nuclear contaminants, and of course, if chemical and biological agents are ever employed, you'll need to be able to do that as well. I forgot to mention, a lot of our clients use these for fire shelters in California and other areas in the West where they have housing developments in the mountains. The developer can save the cost of building 15 or 20 miles of road out of these mountain developments as an alternate fire escape by deploying these shelters underground near their houses. So you need to take into consideration enough room for the occupants, ventilation. We need to have a good closure or a door on the shelter so that it would protect the occupants from, you know, the threat, obviously. So that's basically it. Shielding, ventilation. Of course, there are other considerations. You could get by with just a flashlight or candle in your shelter, but we like to have a more realistic approach with battery-powered backup systems for lighting and so forth. And then you can really get down to the nitty-gritty as far as meal preparation and furniture and so forth. That's basically the essentials.
So how do you handle the air exchange? Like, how do you, you know, is there any kind of electricity used in that? Is it a passive system? What type of filtering do you need to get something like anthrax or radioactivity out of air that we're going to be breathing? Because if we go down in that hole and we pipe in air that's not, you know, filtered, you might as well be standing on the surface.
You might as well be standing on the surface. You're absolutely correct. We import a air handling system or ventilator from Switzerland, because Switzerland is the world leader in civil defense technology, having more than enough shelters for their entire population. So we bring in the outside air, and it passes through a pre-filter, which strips out dust particles larger than 10 microns, and then that air goes into an NBC filter, which weighs about 175 pounds that sits on the floor, and that strips out all of your known chemical, biological, war gases and aerosols, and the Swiss actually test their filters against actual chemical and biological agents in the laboratory. And then, of course, it's pulled through the air pump and dispersed into the shelter.
So there's an electrical requirement there. Then this is not.
Well, actually, we can run it on either 110 volt electricity, or by hand. And the Swiss are wise enough to know that in wartime electricity is a luxury.
Yeah.
And but your shelter occupants still have to have breathable air. So even their very large ventilation systems in their shelters that hold thousands of people have 12-man crankshafts on them.
Wow.
And so if there's a hiccup with the generator, they immediately select 12-man crews to go turn these large crankshafts. They have to turn about 30 revolutions per minute, so it's not a big deal. But they have thought of that situation. And the 110-volt requirement basically is only about 3 amps.
Okay.
And so it is a fairly efficient, you know, from the standpoint of electrical energy consumption, it's a pretty efficient air pump. But the neat thing to notice on the air handler is that it's actually a pump rather than a blower, and it takes a lot of vacuum power to pull the air through those filters and disperse it into the shelter. I noticed a few years ago that we had a 4-foot snowfall on our shelter in the mountains. And I considered clearing away the air pipe, but I thought, no, let's see if we get any air through 4 feet of snow. And of course, it effortlessly pulled air through 4 feet of snow, and you could ventilate our shelter without any problem.
Very cool, because you wouldn't want to go up there if there was fallout or something to clear the snow off. So that's cool.
You get the benefit of the snow to do that for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard you mention burying shipping containers a while ago, and there is some of that on the internet, some material on that. I highly advise people to avoid doing that, because all of the people that we have been talking to who have done that have seen their shipping containers ultimately collapse, because they are not designed to sustain several hundred tons of dirt over the top of their flat roof. They are designed to be stacked one on top of the other, with the load being taken up by the edges of the containers. But burying them, you know, underground is not a good idea. So go some other route.
Yeah, the only way I've ever seen that work is when they're fully timbered. Where they're not really doing the load bearing, the timbering, or I've also seen people frame them out with I-beam steel and supports,
right.
Like you're putting a mine shaft in. And it's a lot of work.
It is.
So all the savings seems to evaporate when they do that.
Yeah. I've also seen people use a concrete slab, you know, over the roof that extends several feet over both sides of the trench. And that can work as well, but you have to address, you know, taking that load, that static load. So, so anyway, that's why we went with the corrugated culvert pipe approach, because it's designed for deep burial. We actually can bury our shelters up to 44 feet deep. We've never done that.
Wow.
But the culvert industry allows for our particular gauge weight and diameter to be buried 44 feet deep. We only go 20 feet deep.
Okay.
The culvert shelter concept was tested by the U.S. government in the 1960s atmospheric nuclear weapons tests, and they performed quite well, surviving within a few hundred yards of the crater edge of a ground burst and directly beneath any airburst nuclear weapon. And so that's why we primarily stick with the corrugated pipe.
Cool. Very cool. I also wanted to, and you mentioned something there, and when I got your notes for the show, and then you mentioned it again here, I researched this and found out something I had no idea, and that is that you mentioned the Swiss being the leaders in civil defense, but they're building, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shelters monthly, and they keep building them. What is the reason for that?
Well, the Swiss correctly understand they take a long view in their defense preparations, and they understand that peacetime is merely the intermission between wars, and that's the period where people pause and stand around and reload and get ready for the next war. Switzerland was the only country in Europe that was not involved in World Wars I and II. Virtually every other country in Europe was devastated by both wars, and their policy of armed neutrality has served them well. And their philosophy is to avoid war. You need to be prepared to make an invasion by an enemy too costly. The price of victory will be too high for someone to contemplate invading Switzerland. And that has worked well. So they just basically made shelters a part of their defense program and a part of their federal building code. So any building intended for human habitation, whether it's a watch shop, grocery store, church, school, hospital, theater, you know, food store, they have to have a blast-hardened NBC shelter on the premises to get an occupation permit. And there is a way that you can get a waiver as a homeowner building a new home. You can get a waiver from the federal authorities if your family lives within 5 minutes of walking distance from a communal shelter. And if you register your family at that particular communal bunker with the authorities, then they will probably issue you a waiver and you don't have to build one in your house.
Interesting. I mean, just kind of striking the difference between the U.S.'s policy on this and the Swiss policy. The Swiss stayed out of the war, weren't building, you know, MX missile systems in the 80s and the 70s, not really considered the huge target. And then the U.S. were, you know, going toe-to-toe during the Cold War with the Soviets, both of us building huge stockpiles, were the target for the other guys. And, of course, they're the target for us. And we didn't really do anything on a national level as far as, you know, shelter building. Why did our government choose not to?
John F. Kennedy was the last U.S. president to actually be candid with the American people about the nature of the threat and appeared on our televisions and advised Americans to build fallout shelters if they had the means to do so. And JFK was going to unveil his concept of an American shelter program, which was very similar to the Swiss program. It was going to cost billions of dollars. And that died with John Kennedy in Dallas. Lyndon Johnson immediately scrapped the shelter program and accelerated our involvement in Southeast Asia and the rest of history. Ronald Reagan tried to revive civil defense in the 1980s, proposing to increase the federal budget for civil defense from $200 million to $7 billion a year and begin building shelters. And, of course, he was mocked and savaged for that idea. And that died. So basically the American people are kept pretty much in the dark about the nuclear, biological, chemical threat. And, politicians figured out a long time ago that scared voters don't vote for incumbents. So if the electorate is kept ignorant and comfortable, then they continue to reelect people who don't pay any attention to the problem. And I see the problem now is that we have been distracted by our adventures in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, and we have focused most of our resources and attention on the Islamic terrorist threat, and we have completely turned away from our near-peer rivals, the Communist China and Russia, of course, and so we have totally neglected our nuclear deterrence. And the Russians and Chinese continue to maintain and modernize their nuclear forces.
Yeah, so we don't do it. The Swiss do it. Are there any other countries that have, you know, heavy-duty programs in place for doing civil defense shelters?
That's a good question, and the answer is yes. South Korea has a large shelter program, Kuwait. Saudi Arabia now has large shelter programs since the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Sweden, Finland, Norway all have large shelter programs. Israel, of course, they, as we saw in the 2008 our 2006 rocket campaign, there were a lot of news stories filmed inside Israeli bunkers when Katusha rockets were raining down on the Israelis. Russia and China both have shelter programs. They tend to be focused on their critical industrial areas because they want to preserve their, obviously, their manufacturing base in case of war. I seem to remember reading a story here not too long ago about the Olympics being held in Seoul, South Korea. And one of the athletes remarked that he was told when he arrived in his hotel that if they did blow the air raid sirens for a drill, that you had a couple of minutes to get into a shelter. And if you were found wandering around, you know, within, outside of that grace period, then you'd be arrested. So they, you know, some of these countries who have an eye toward protecting their populations have spent a lot of money on civil defense shelters.
Yeah, I mean, South Korea especially, the North there says that one day they'll turn it into a sea of fire. And even if you discount the little bit of nuclear technology, it seems that the North has the conventional weaponry on something as small as the Korean Peninsula that's trained on the South. Now you can see why they would want to do that.
Oh, absolutely. North Korea is basically a armed camp, and they have an unbelievable amount of tube type and missile artillery trained on the DMZ and in the Seoul area. And so South Korea does face a very serious threat, as does Israel and some of the other countries in the high-stress areas around the world. But Switzerland just merely continues, you know, maintaining that standard. And they understand correctly that war is not a thing of the past, that we will have more wars. Not quite sure how they're going to unfold, but war will be with us for quite some time, and they understand that peacetime is the best time to prepare for that.
Yeah, makes me think of something my friend, who actually was a member of a Soviet military named Valery Azanov, used to say, that they said all the time, is those who sweat the most in peace bleed the least in war.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot to be said for that. But I also, you know, I know him because, you know, he was actually a member of the KGB, and he left Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed. And that kind of brings us to another subject that you had sent me some information on, and that's like, you know, we watched the Soviet Union collapse, and we say, okay, great, the big threat's gone, ignoring China, sitting right there, and nothing changed there. But in some ways, maybe it did reduce the direct threat of nuclear war on some levels, but at the same time, it decentralized a lot of things. Val told me he left and went to went to London because basically, since he was ex-KGB, he had two choices: join the Russian mafia or leave, because no one else would have you. So a lot of people like left Russia like that, like including this one guy you sent me an article about that made like some of the most advanced anthrax ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new threat that I don't think people really understand how big the biological side of the threat is.
Well, you're correct, and biologicals kind of reared its ugly head right after the 9/11 thing in the Ames anthrax case, which turns out somebody at one of the labs, I think Fort Detrick, had some kind of political agenda and was manufacturing his own weapons-grade anthrax and circulating it in the mail. But that did get, you know, some press time, and people became a little concerned about that. And then it, you know, when we figured out what was going on, it faded away. But Russia, I believe, still maintains a biological weapons program, and most of our adversary nations continue because they're cheap and they are devastatingly effective and they don't break any windows. So I remember attending a lecture by the late Conrad Chester from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, who made a slide presentation to the American Civil Defense Association just before he passed away. And He had a slide up on his up on a screen which showed the cost of depopulating or killing a 1 square mile area with various kinds of weapons, and the most expensive one was airstrikes at a cost of about $12 million per square mile, and the next most expensive was artillery. About $10 million per square mile, And then we dropped down to nuclear explosives, which was about $2 million per square mile. And at the bottom of the chart was anthrax, that cost $40.
Wow,
so
$40,
the neat thing about anthrax is that you can disperse it over a wide area. And, you know, if we deploy it by an aircraft, such as a long-range bomber, it carries tons of it, literally, they can fly, you know, patterns across the United States at night and disperse this agent at about two pounds per linear mile. And as those aerosols drift with the wind, they can create a lot of casualties up to 400 miles downwind. That's a large area for one platform to totally depopulate.
It doesn't require any precision delivery either.
No,
It's its own smart bomb because it's everywhere.
Yes. The neat thing about anthrax from the standpoint of the user is that the next day when the sun comes out, sunlight degrades anthrax pretty rapidly. So a day or two of complete sunshine would probably deactivate any agent that is exposed to the sun. Of course, that doesn't count anything that drifted into buildings, carpet, clothing, attics, air systems, and so forth. But it's not transmissible from one person to another. So you can largely control the borders of an anthrax, using anthrax on a big population. But if you release something like smallpox, that hops from one person to another extremely readily. And that would be a weapon that would, you know, keep on infecting long, long, long after it was dispersed. And I don't think anybody would use smallpox unless they're total idiots. Unless the United States were completely shut down after a nuclear strike, where maritime and civil air traffic has largely ceased. Nonetheless, we have, you know, some nasty minds out there who have considerable resources to develop and build and deploy nuclear weapon, biological aerosols. And that's a pretty scary thought in itself.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's actually, to me, more likely to occur than something like a nuclear strike. Nuclear weapons are expensive to build. They require a lot of technology, and generally they're in the hands of government. And I don't agree with a lot of things that George Bush Jr. said. I don't really like any politician, but one thing he said that made a lot of sense to me with nuclear weapons, he said, "I'm not really that concerned with the country that wants 1,000 of them. I'm concerned with the person that wants one." So I think our biggest threat is that individual weapon there. But like you said, anthrax, you can wipe out a square mile with $40. I've heard a lot of people in the defense industry call bio and chemical weapons the poor man's nuclear bomb.
It is. And in fact, they may be even more devastating from the casualty standpoint than nuclear weapons if they're used by somebody who knows what they're doing. The other factor, going back to proliferation, is we have Pakistan, who has a pretty modern nuclear program. They understand how to build multi-stage weapons, you know, fission-fusion weapons and so forth. They understand miniaturization of weapons, and they've tested a thermonuclear weapon. The problem I see with Pakistan is we don't really know who in their program is likely to siphon off or, you know, lose or sell a weapon to a rogue terrorist nation or group. And I don't worry so much about, you know, one being smuggled into a city, although that would be terrible. What I worry about most is sending that weapon to a country like Iran, who has a mature intermediate-range ballistic missile program. And Iran is looking for a nuclear weapon to put on one of their intermediate-range ballistic missiles and possibly launch that from a ship in the Gulf of Mexico over the central part of the U.S. and do what's called an EMP shot. I'm sorry, I have a Sikorsky helicopter flying overhead here. So if someone were to successfully detonate a nuclear weapon over the central part of the United States at the right altitude, we would be a third world country in a minute. And it wouldn't hurt anyone on the ground initially, but it would completely shut down our electrical infrastructure and basically destroy all unprotected microcircuits, chips, and so forth. And we are totally dependent on this technology to provide drinking water and other utilities and fuel and food and medical support and all the other things critical to, you know, keeping our population alive. And with a single warhead, a tiny country like Iran or North Korea could successfully destroy the United States as a viable power.
Yeah, and I think if they were to maybe use the half a dozen of them spread out, they could really make sure they got the job done. And that doesn't seem like that big of a task for them to accomplish.
Well, it's a proven fact that a single low-yield nuclear weapon, if designed properly, and the blueprints are readily available on the Internet, but there are enhanced EMP weapons, and they're projected to be able to do a 100% EMP laydown on the entire continental United States.
Wow.
And that is certainly well within the heavy lift capability of the Shahab 3 and its variants. And there's another new intermediate-range ballistic missile in use by Iran that could lift an even larger weapon. And the bad thing about what makes this more viable is that if the launching party destroyed the ship that they launched from, there would be absolutely no chance of figuring out who launched the missile.
Who did it?
And so the whole concept of mutual assured destruction is dead, because you don't go burning down, you know, 200 million people in another country or 50 million people in another country on a suspicion. You have to know who did it. And we probably wouldn't even retaliate anyway, because, you know, there's 200 million people. Really isn't the problem. It's the leadership.
Sure.
And so we probably wouldn't retaliate in any case. But the fact is the experts are projecting if we did suffer an EMP strike that it would eliminate about 90% of the U.S. population over a one-year period.
Wow. Wow. All right, so let's say, you know, I'm sold on the idea. I decide I want to build a shelter for myself and my family. Typical, you know, American family of four. What type of size are they going to need in general? What's going to be the expense, the cost of doing this? I know that varies because, you know, one guy has, like, really easy soil to dig in. The other guy's loaded with rocks and boulders. But, you know, kind of a general ballpark.
Well, you know, I often get asked the question, how many people can fit in a certain size shelter? And the answer is, it depends on how scared they are. the most popular, yeah. I actually talked to a woman who lived in Germany. She spent her 8th birthday in a Berlin bomb shelter and said they were packed in there so tightly that they literally fell asleep standing up and spent the entire night listening to the air raids from her bunker. But, you know, you do what you have to do to stay alive. And now, size-wise, our most popular size is the 10x50, a 10-foot diameter tube with a 50-foot length. And the reason is because it's the cheapest per square foot cost that we can make, because the fixed costs on building the shelter are the steel bulkheads on the end and the entrances and the ladder and the air handler and the hatches or the Swiss doors, depending on how you're doing it. And so all these costs are the same no matter how long you make the shelter. The cheapest part is the length. And so the smallest, there's only about a $13,000 spread between the smallest shelter we make to the largest shelter we make. So from the standpoint of storing extra food, water, soap, antibiotics, medical supplies, tools, clothes, shoes, you know, whatever, whatever you are able to pack into that shelter is most likely what you'll get to live on for an extended period of time, because the supply chain will be largely destroyed.
And I mean,
so the larger shelter we build runs around $60,000.
Okay.
And that's the shipping cost. That's the ship, you know, the drive away cost. And then installation runs anywhere from $8,000 to $20,000, depending on how sophisticated your installation is and the job site and whether you have to blast, you know, local conditions, how far you have to go to get fresh rock and so forth. But that's the ballpark figure. The cost of a shelter, and our target when we got into this was to build a highly efficient, high protection shelter for about the cost of a new well-equipped pickup truck. And if you go down to your Ford dealer and price a crew cab diesel pickup truck, they run about $58,000 or more, depending on what, sure, what options you order.
Sure. So you're not that far off. But it isn't something that everybody's going to just run out tomorrow and throw on the Beast card to be able to buy. But if you have the means, I can see the reason to do so.
Well, there are a lot of people that are in my income bracket. I'm kind of a low to middle income guy. And they get two or three other families together, and they pool their resources, and they have a common piece of ground. And they all chip in about a third, and so that brings it down to about $20,000.
Which makes a lot more sense for the average person to be able to
do. It does. And you get the added advantage of having the skill sets of the additional people involved in your project. So maybe someone in another family is a nurse or a dentist or an engineer or, you know, a former military. So you have the opportunity to bring more skills into your readiness project.
Absolutely. What are some, you've mentioned that you do supply materials for people that are building their own shelters. What are some of the approaches you've seen taken there that have actually worked and been worth doing?
Well, we work with a lot of customers who have very generous resources, and they build concrete shelters. And concrete is a good material, provided you use enough of it, and it's designed properly. One of the most popular items that we provide is the Swiss armored doors, which basically is a door frame and a door leaf that is filled with concrete. It has two curtains of rebar on it on the 4-inch centers. And the door is designed to be cast into the concrete wall when you're building the shelter. And after 2 weeks of cure time, then you can form up the door leaf, which rests on the outside of the door frame. It does not recess into the door frame. I'll get to that in a second. But later on, the door leaf is formed up, it's closed, and concrete is poured through the fill holes in the top of the leaf. And after 3 days, you can strip the forms off the leaf, and you have a Swiss glass door. I see some people using cast-in security vault doors, and they work great for gun safes and valuables, but those doors are not designed for structures that could be exposed to blast effects, because if the door frame were to be distorted in any way, then you cannot open the door. And that's why the Swiss armored door has the door leaf locked on or positioned on the outside of the door frame, bearing against the frame and the wall, so that even if the frame were to be severely distorted, you can still easily open the door and self-rescue.
Yeah, so you don't get stuck in your shelter. Your shelter doesn't become a tomb.
That would become a tomb, and that's not the end desired result.
Yeah, there's cheaper ways to bury yourself after you're gone than in a $60,000 blast shelter. A thing I've seen people do to build, mostly more for a storm shelter type situation, but seems to have worked fairly well. You mentioned you use the corrugated pipe in your shelters, but I've seen at times where there's major civil works projects where they're putting in that huge concrete pipe, and they have some left over. And if you buy it new, it's expensive, but when they have some left over, you can usually get it dirt cheap, comparatively speaking. Concrete, and that would seem to work really well.
Concrete pipe is very rugged, and in fact, the Swiss use concrete pipe in some of their military small field fortifications. I have no problem with concrete pipe. Very rugged stuff.
Cool. Well, if folks want to talk to you about putting in a shelter, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, we have a website, and it's called UtahShelterSystems.com. And our contact information is on there. I can be reached directly by email at PSEYFRIED@UtahShelterSystems.com. That's all on the website. And I can I take calls on my cell phone, which is 801-631-7684. And we do provide a lot of self-help to people who are doing their own, and if they just need information, we're happy to provide things like the Swiss building code for concrete shelters, and maybe help people tweak their own, you know, building plans and so forth, help them avoid some of the pitfalls we've already seen. And but we're just more into promoting the general readiness for the American people, and we are quite vulnerable to a lot of threats.
And when you guys do your installations, are you geographically limited to like an area that you cover, or?
We mostly cover the United States and Canada.
Okay, but you're nationwide.
Yes.
Okay. So you don't have to live in Utah to get a shelter.
No.
Utah shelter systems.
Our shelters, you can ship it by truck virtually anywhere. I'm not really wild about Florida because their water table is extraordinarily high.
Yeah.
That's a limitation for our shelters. They cannot go into the water table.
Oh, that's interesting.
But in many other areas of the country, they have appropriate conditions, and they work really well.
Very, very cool. Well, Paul, I appreciate you being with us today on the Survival Podcast and opening up our eyes, I think, to some threats that people tend to overlook.
I believe so.
Well, folks, today it's been Jack Spearco along with Paul Seyfried helping you figure out how to live that better life. It's time to get tough. Or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com, anytime you shop online. And while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.